Welcome to the Author Talks. This is our first one this year, and we're pleased that we have folks that have come out to hear these wonderful authors talk this afternoon about their books. First in our talk this afternoon is Dr. Jennifer Trost. She's new to Muskingum. She came in this past summer, August of 2006. Jennifer is a visiting associate professor of criminal justice in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Her book, Gateway to Justice, the Juvenile Court and Progressive Child Welfare in a Southern City, was published in 2006 by the University of Georgia Press. It's part of a series, The Studies in the Legal History of the South. The first book-length study of the early juvenile justice system in the American South is what this book is. It looks at the juvenile courts in Memphis, Tennessee, that was founded in 1910. She looks at how delinquent and dependent children were directed into a variety of private charitable organizations and public correctional institutions and facilities. Trost draws on the court's case files, other primary sources, and welfare officials in the urban South. She adds a personal dimension to her study by focusing on people who appeared before the court. The court in Memphis, Tennessee was directed for 30 years by the charismatic and well-known Chief Judge Camille Kelly. It was a traditional house of justice, a social service provider, an agent of state control, and a community-based mediator. Gateway to Justice is a work of legal history, although the questions are more commonly posed by social historians. This book will engage anyone interested in how the early welfare state was shaped and started, and the tensions between the public standards and the private practices of parenting, sexuality, and race relations. Welcome, Dr. Trost, as you discuss Gateway to Justice. And I'll ask Dr. Trost if she'll talk for maybe 15 or 20 minutes and then allow us to ask some questions.
Sure.
And I understand you brought a book with a cover on. Ours is a hardback, so ours has a little nicer cover. We're doing a podcast, as I think they mentioned to you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be asked to speak here and happy to be here this afternoon at my new school. And that was a lovely introduction. I thought I would give a little bit of background both about the actual research and how I did the research and turned the research into a book. And I think most of us do research for both personal and academic reasons. And when I was growing up in West Texas, my junior high was being racially integrated, and I rode the bus to a magnet school across town, actually to the Hispanic high school. And my school district was under federal desegregation orders for 25 years and finally declared itself desegregated in 1995, but really it wasn't, because those dimensions of high school continued to exist. And I also remember taking pictures of graffiti on the side of a wall, and it said, "Lubbock police are Nazis after all non-whites." So I was really surrounded by mixed messages about social justice and the law and race. And graduate school allowed me to explore those issues about how Americans, particularly Southerners, defined and pursued social justice. My start with social welfare began with Michael Katz's book, In the Shadow of the Poorhouse, and he inspired me to look at the ideas about how justice are reflected in institutions. And even though his title claimed to be about America, it was really only about New York. And so that pointed me in the direction of Southern social welfare. And when I started this research, colleagues of mine said, "Well, you're not going to find any social welfare in the South. You know, those are contradictory terms." But actually, they were wrong. And in addition, criminologists had really shaped the field of juvenile justice, and as a result, we know a lot about the recent experiences of African Americans in juvenile justice, but very little about their historical experiences. And so juvenile justice now is really just beginning to address the court treatment of minorities and neglected children, the history of their experiences, and one of the best places to study that issue and that intersection of issues is in the South. Social historians examine race and gender by looking beneath the, frankly, false rhetoric of equality and justice and looking at the operations of institutions. And one of the things that I had to do was a lot of counting and coding of decisions that the judge made, where the children came from, what their background was like. And actions reveal more than words, especially when it comes to controversial issues such as race, which is masked in coded language, and gender, which is often in the background. And what I and others have found is that juvenile courts operated a sexual double standard, where girls, but not boys, were punished for sexual activity. And I also found that black and white families and neighbors turned to the juvenile court for assistance with their family problems, with their community problems, and sometimes they got what they wanted, and sometimes they got more than they wanted. And surprisingly, juvenile courts, but not the police, in Memphis and Los Angeles and other places, didn't punish black children more harshly than white children. The police did, but the juvenile courts themselves didn't. Particularly if we use incarceration as the most harsh form of punishment. And so that's actually a very heartening thing to find out, that once children get to the juvenile court, it really does serve to protect them from the harsh adult system. And that's one of the most important contributions of Southern juvenile courts, is that they keep black children, boys and girls, out of the adult system. And my work in Memphis also shows that black boys and girls were overrepresented in the juvenile court system. This is not unusual, and that continues to this day. But what I found instead historically was that fewer resources were devoted to black children than white children. And although black leaders worked to gain access to the juvenile court for their children and to protect them, public officials really declined to offer a lot of resources to black children, but rather just return them to their families. So the way we could summarize juvenile court is not much help, but not much punishment either. And if your comparison is the previous system, then this is an improvement. You know, if your ideal is some sort of equitable and, you know, generous system, then it doesn't measure up to that. But I think it's important to compare, you know, the past to its own past rather than some future or ideal. But people in the community really operated the system of justice. And so far I've been speaking about the boys and girls who've been on the receiving end of this justice, working class parents and their children, because they are working class, and how they responded and what they hoped to gain. They asked for help mediating between husbands and wives. They asked for help with unruly children, particularly girls who were going out with boys. They asked for help from their sons who were, you know, chunking rocks or stealing bikes. The police did gather up black boys in particular who stole coal from the railroad yards. This was a very common strategy among poor black families, was to get coal and either use it for themselves or sell it to other black families. And white boys didn't really do that to the same extent. But the other important personality was my chief judge, Camille Kelly, and she was the judge for 30 years. She was appointed initially and then continued to win elections after that. And she was kind of an interesting, and I have an ambivalent relationship to her work. She felt that she was, as a mother, uniquely suited to preside over a court of children. And she participated and advocated a sexual double standard, although she might not have seen it that way. So while, you know, she worked herself, she critiqued other women who did. She was, however, silent about her views on race. She spoke a lot about the differences between girls and boys and what they needed to be corrected. But she didn't really articulate her racial views. The only way I know what she did racially was to follow the court decisions. And I used those case files to track her decisions, and those are the reflection of Southern racial and gender attitudes. And she's an interesting woman because on the one hand, she is a working mother. But on the other hand, she publicly said she thought mothers best serve their children by being at home. She participated in a high-powered world with Jane Addams, national legal organizations, but she always stressed motherhood rather than her professional experience as her, you know, qualification. She spoke and portrayed herself as a friend in court. She never wore robes. She always wore a dress, and she had this flower. A little cheesy, but she did. She was famous for her flowers. But the interesting point is that even though she articulated this very maternalist philosophy, her decisions are really no different from other juvenile courts that were run by men. Comparisons of other juvenile courts show the same kind of sexual double standard, show the same kind of attempts to intervene in working class families. So one of the things I found is that there really is this sort of language of female judicial philosophy, but the actions are similar to patriarchal courts. As in racial issues, the operations of the juvenile court, like gender, reveal ambiguity with regard to gender, because we have a female judge who's controlling female sexuality. She's helping families, but she's also controlling female sexuality. You know, she doesn't have harsh racial views, but she is policing race relations. She gave mothers a hard time about their living situation and their sexual behavior when they came in front of her, but she knew perfectly well that they needed to take in boarders, that they were often single mothers. So she has this very complex relationship with her own clients. And my research makes two main contributions. One is to racial history of juvenile justice, and the other is to welfare history of the South. Juvenile courts have always been racially diverse, and there are scholars who have said that it's really only since the 60s and 70s that we've had a lot of African Americans in the juvenile justice system, and that's simply not true. And my study shows that black and white children parents use the juvenile court to control their unruly children. They actually went to the court and called it into their families rather than the court going into the families on its own. I call my study the Gateway to Justice because a variety of people turned to the court and they got a variety of services from the court. And it was very much a progressive institution. And in this way, the South is part of this national process of using the state to help working class families deal with insecurities in the wage labor market and industrialization. And it offered shelter. It didn't challenge capitalism, obviously, but it offered, you know, some basic help. And last year's decision in March by the Supreme Court to prohibit the death penalty for juveniles as cruel and unusual punishment shows that we're still very much thinking about these issues of juveniles and the way they're different from adults. And as a historian, I find that our current system is actually a lot like the pre-juvenile court days of the 19th century, particularly for black young men. They're being sent to prison now at higher rates than white delinquents, much like they were before the juvenile court. And so obviously institutions are a product of their time, and I really admire the optimism and determination of the progressives as they tackled these problems, however imperfectly. So that's really the findings that I have to share with you. And although the research was rather painful, and I started In the spring of 1993 and finished the research in the spring of 1996, and the book came out in 2005. So you see it was a fairly long time to come to this stage. Doing the book itself was really quite fun. And in January of 2003, I sent my proposal out to a number of academic presses that I knew did legal history and Southern history, and the University of Georgia Press agreed to read the manuscript rather quickly, and I had readers' reports that fall. I sent off the page proofs in August of 2004, wrapped in duct tape just ahead of Hurricane Ivan, because I wanted to make sure that if it hit me, at least my manuscript was safe. And ironically, Ivan hit west of us and went straight through Atlanta. So I was a little upset about that. But nevertheless, the book came out in March of 2005. And my favorite part, actually, is the cover, which you can maybe look at in a bit. But the press did a super nice job of taking this photograph from 1910, and they framed it. It's a little black boy holding a teddy bear, and he's standing on the front porch of the juvenile court. And so I always make this argument that this is a way that you can see the institution, in essence, protecting his childhood. You know, the juvenile court is making him safe, and I contrast this image with children on the street shining shoes and selling newspapers, and that this is what the juvenile court is designed to prevent and to let the little kiddo have his teddy bear. And so I like this a lot as well, because there's an African American child on here, and this is one of the major contributions, just to show that, however imperfectly, the juvenile court certainly does provide protection for vulnerable children. So that's really all I have to say about the findings and the process. If you have any, should we do questions now? I don't know if any of you have questions about the writing process or the research process. I spent a semester in the basement of the juvenile court, windowless room, looking through case files. Do you have a question?
Exactly what time period were you studying?
The specific case files I used were from the 1920s. And I did a sample of 3 years throughout the 1920s. And I originally envisioned the project as a two-decade-long study from the 20s and the 30s, and when I got there, I quickly realized that there was more information than I could really deal with for two decades. And so I scaled it back and had thought maybe I would go back again and make some comparisons, because the juvenile court was founded in 1910. It was kind of a corrupt and hack system for the first 10 years. And then when Camille Kelly became the judge, she really professionalized it, brought in psychologists, had, you know, standard case file work. And so it was really a smoothly operating court all through the 1920s. And then I wanted to see how it was going to react to the pressures of the Depression. And that work remains to be done. And I call it the progressive era because, and that's traditionally 1890 to 1920 or so. And those kind of ideas began in the Northeast and then moved throughout the country. And so that's partly why I call it progressivism. Even though it's the 1920s, the ideas in the juvenile court were very much part of this national movement. And they came in the 1920s. So that's why I did that time period.
Did the courts have the mandate or interest or resources to do any follow-ups on the children getting cold and doing other juvenile delinquent kind of activities?
Yeah, I could see that she would do this sort of incremental punishment. The first thing she would do is, you know, shake her finger and send them back home, and then if they came back again, she would put them on probation, and if they came back again, she'd send them to the industrial school or, you know, a couple of times, and then ultimately she would send them to the state juvenile facility, which was farther east. And so those were cases that I could follow, and then ultimately there were some of them who went to the adult system. You know, they were basically in the correctional system their entire lives. But they were very much overworked. I mean, the probation officers, I, you know, estimated had 100 cases each. And of course, there was only one black male probation officer and one black female probation officer. And there were several white female probation officers and white male probation officers. So the caseload for the black officers would have been quite a bit higher. And I also have a chart from internal records of the juvenile court, which laid out the salaries of everybody. And, you know, they're so cheap, right? The black probation officer got paid less than the court stenographer. And, you know, he had a lot of work to do. So there were a lot of ways that the court system was very racially minded. My case files were color-coded on the outside so that they would write the case number in red if it was a black child, and they'd write it in black if it was a white child. And they even changed the color of the ink in the typewriter when they went from a black case to a white case. And that continued until the 50s. So, you know, it was, and then the detention centers were segregated, you know, white detention home and a colored detention home, and that was actually in the Memphis Municipal Code, that there will be two different detention homes. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by that. And I suppose, you know, it certainly does demonstrate, you know, a very racially conscious city, but I also know that if those black boys hadn't gone to the black detention home center, they would have gone to prison or they would have gone to jail. So, you know, it is, you know, I guess it is better. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yes, the color coding. In the 1950s, was there some other mechanism that signaled the same thing, only less blatantly?
Well, they would make those notes in, you know, that's part of the intake stuff where they would have, you know, married or sing, you know, whether they lived with two parents or one parent. And so that would just be part of, you know, it would just be in the narrative rather than visually. And plus, I was kind of careful not to poke around too much in the more recent stuff or really indicate that I was interested in any of the more recent stuff, partly because of confidentiality issues. But there was a scandal in the 50s with my judge, and people in Memphis were a little bit sensitive about it, and so I didn't really want to make them question my motives by poking around. And there was another book written about that issue, and she was should tell you. She was accused of using her power as the juvenile court judge by forcing girls who came before her who were pregnant to give up their daughters to this adoption agency, and those children were then later adopted out to celebrity couples in California. It's all very complicated. But that's part of the reason why I didn't go into that later time period, because it was, you know, it's a little unclear what happened, and I didn't delve too much into that. I mean, she was actually a very powerful figure, and she, you know, maybe got in over her head, I don't know. But at the time, she was sort of a heroine, I think. Any questions?
Has anybody looked into that or written about?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the first book that they wrote about her. And people would always say to me, well, you know about the scandal. And I said, well, yeah, I'm not really interested in that. And they said, oh, but, you know. And I said, well, that was later. The evidence for that is a little inconclusive, and that really wasn't my primary interest. I was really interested in the social welfare dimensions and the racial dimension. Memphis was a really nice case study because at the time in the 1920s, it was just about half black and half white. So it was easy to see the overrepresentation of African Americans in the juvenile court, and, you know, see how the various agencies dealt with white and black kids. And, you know, those agencies were all segregated as well. And the United Way was segregated. There's a whole separate set for black kids and black families. And so there was an entirely segregated system, publicly at any rate, because certainly privately, you know, white families had black women doing their laundry, had black women taking care of their kids, and there was a lot of private integration. And so this idea of segregation is very much a legal and public phenomenon, and privately there's a lot of intermingling. And we certainly know that's true in rural areas, and that's definitely true in urban areas as well. Yeah. Well, you know, we've experimented a lot in juvenile justice, and one of the things that certainly happened since the 60s is that the welfare duties of the court have been stripped away and absorbed by, you know, departments of welfare, and all that's left for the juvenile court now is this criminal function. And my argument at the time was that it was both welfare, it was neglected and delinquent children. And right now, juvenile court is really just delinquent children. And there are scholars who have argued that we should abolish the entire juvenile court because it's just really a kiddie criminal court. And that we should, you know, just have an adult system that has special attention to children. I mean, there are a lot of proposed reforms to deal with basically a new set of crimes. You know, the kinds of crimes that I'm writing about are not the same kinds of crimes that juvenile courts have to deal with now. And I just don't see us going back to a more well-developed welfare juvenile court. Certainly not now, you know, in 2006, and certainly not in the last 10 or 15 years. And I think that basically, you know, the problems are generally, you know, market-based, and we need market-based solutions rather than criminal justice-based solutions, because a lot of these problems that these kids are dealing with are about economic instability, lack of economic opportunity, poor housing, and until we really have serious economic solutions, we're going to continue to muddle around with this sort of, you know, half-baked criminal, you know, juvenile justice institution. So I think the solutions are much bigger than I've ever seen any policy offered. Okay. Thank you very much.